Good morning and welcome to the Tuesday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. On Wednesday, Britain will change prime ministers for the third time this century, 9 weeks ahead of schedule. The battle to succeed David Cameron was uniquely being fought between two women, experienced Home Secretary Theresa May and Andrea Leadsom, a relatively junior energy minister. Leadsom shocked her party by suddenly pulling out on Monday afternoon, only 4 days after a final ballot of Conservative Members of Parliament, MPs, had whittled down the contest to this final pairing. The Conservative Party's membership was supposed to take the summer to decide whether to choose May, viewed as a safe pair of hands, or opt for a fresh face in Leadsom. It was the latest day of drama in what has been one of the most tumultuous periods of peacetime politics in UK history, following the country's shock referendum vote to leave the European Union on June 23rd, a decision that forced Cameron to resign barely a year after he had won the general election. "Nothing surprises me in politics after the past few weeks," says Graham Brady, a Conservative MP and chairman of the party's Private Members Committee, a powerful group of Tory backbenchers known informally as the 1922 Committee, which plays a key role in how the party's leader is chosen. It was Brady who Leadsom called Monday morning to say she was pulling out of the leadership contest. Although she had comfortably survived an elimination process that had reduced the number of candidates from 5 to 2, she was well behind May. The Home Secretary had the support of 199 MPs, more than double Leadsom's total of 84. "It was clear to me that she had been reflecting on her position since the result of the ballot on Thursday, which had shown overwhelming support among her parliamentary colleagues for Theresa May," Brady tells Time. "She was very exercised about a speedy resolution to provide the stability the country needs." Leadsom had carried the hopes of the so-called Brexiteers, having campaigned to leave the EU and becoming a star of the campaign, performing well in televised debates. May backed Cameron's pledge to remain in the EU, but as a natural Eurosceptic had been fairly silent during the referendum. She suffered a blow to her credibility on Saturday, though, when she appeared to suggest in an interview with the London Times that she would make a better prime minister than May because, unlike her rival, she was a mother and therefore more invested in the future. A furious Leadsom condemned the journalist's interpretation of her remarks, though the recording showed the quotes were accurate. It has since been speculated that the furor sparked Leadsom's decision to exit the race, although a source close to her insists this had fired her up and nearly convinced her to plow on. But Leadsom was already minded to concede victory to May, the source says, because she felt party grandees were briefing against her in a ruthless campaign to make sure the establishment candidate won. Leadsom and her family had suffered, quote, "an absolute barrage from people who really should know better," the source continues, which had included allegations that she had exaggerated her career in London's financial district on her resume. There was also the concern that Leadsom could win a majority of Conservative members, yet not command the support of her parliamentary colleagues. "The Labour Party opposition has found itself in this very situation under the hard left Jeremy Corbyn, who as a result is facing a leadership challenge from former Shadow Business Secretary Angela Eagle." Leadsom spoke to Tim Loughton, her campaign manager and friend of 35 years, on Sunday evening to say she would withdraw. Meanwhile, May was preparing an official leadership launch speech on the economy for Monday morning in Birmingham. In the 2 weeks since the Brexit vote, May had made fewer public statements than her rivals and instead sat back and watched them implode. Housing Minister Brandon Lewis, a supporter of May, said the Home Secretary is uninterested in the kind of frantic Westminster politicking that ensued after the Brexit vote. "Theresa doesn't get caught up in the games that other people get involved in," he said. "She's very clear that she has a job to do on the economy and stability." On Monday, rumors of Leadsom's decision started circulating among the press at around 10:30 a.m. local time. News reached May's team after journalists contacted her loyalists for comment. The news broke on Twitter at 11:30 a.m. May supporter James Cleverly tells Time he was in a meeting of MPs from Essex, the part of the country he represents, when he noticed his colleagues were distracted by their phones and watched the story unfold online. His first reaction was relief that a grueling leadership contest had been averted, he says. I was sad for Andrea, but pleased that uncertainty was coming to an end, he says. Leadsom made a public statement confirming her withdrawal at 12:15 p.m., wishing May the very greatest success. Within hours, Cameron confirmed he would be leaving Downing Street on Wednesday evening. Even veteran politicians were shocked at the pace of events. Conservative MP Nigel Evans said he was gobsmacked. Commuting back to London after her Birmingham speech, May was miles away from the events that had brought her to the cusp of power. She was unable to address her cheering MPs outside Parliament until nearly 6 p.m. The Prime Minister-in-waiting will now turn her attention to the formation of her cabinet, with some experts predicting she will move Chancellor George Osborne to Foreign Secretary. The new Prime Minister will also set up a Brexit unit to formally untie the UK from the EU. Rumors suggest former Shadow Home Secretary David Davis will lead it. May was recently described by Tory party grandee Ken Clark in an unguarded moment as a bloody difficult woman, and she has taken it on as a badge of honor, especially when it comes to dealing with the EU. May is preparing to face down European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker to make sure the UK gets the best possible trade deal when it leaves the bloc. May has already said, though, that she won't rush negotiations. Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty, which formally triggers a 2-year process of withdrawal, won't be invoked until next year. That may come as a rare pause after this breathless summer of UK politics. This article posted by Mark Leftley in London. For all the invective that the Chinese hurled at the five men ruling on China's South China Sea claims, actors in a political farce, law abusers who wanted to worsen disputes and destabilize the situation, a suspicious panel led by a lowly official of the former British Empire, the members of the International Tribunal in The Hague appeared unmoved by Beijing's broadsides. On July 12, the Permanent Court of Arbitration, the PCA, unanimously ruled that many of China's claims to the South China Sea had no legal basis. The tribunal specifically rejected China's assertion of historic rights to the vital waterway through a so-called nine-dash line demarcated on Chinese maps, which scoops out nearly all the sea as its own. Chinese state media responded to the long-awaited ruling with an immediate diatribe. Law-abusing tribunal issues ill-founded award, went a tweet from state newswire Xinhua. International network coverage of the panel's decision was intermittently blocked from Chinese airwaves. In a follow-up, Xinhua labeled the tribunal illegal and dangerous. In 2013, the Philippines lodged a case against China with the PCA, questioning Beijing's vast claims over the contested South China Sea, through which more than $5 trillion in trade passes each year. China's nine-dash line overlaps not only with the Philippines' claimed waters, but also laps near the coasts of Malaysia, Brunei, and Vietnam. In total, Beijing's South China Sea claims conflict with those of five other governments, including that of Taiwan. The nation's footprint in the resource-rich expanse has grown far bigger over the past couple of years, as China converted most underwater reefs into islands large enough to welcome fighter jets and house missile batteries. The result has been to fill the South China Sea with Chinese military bases in waters where fishermen from various nations once roamed. Manila decided to pursue international arbitration after China seized effective control of Scarborough Shoal, which is located fewer than 200 nautical miles from the Philippine capital, Manila. The suit was accepted by the PCA last October, and it tackled 15 separate issues. Among other questions, lawyers representing the Philippines asked the tribunal to rule on the legality of the nine-dash line. Beijing has maintained strategic ambiguity about what exactly the demarcation means. Is it just the bits of land within the line, or is it all waters inside the dotted boundary? But either way, China's attachment to the nine-dash line is based on so-called historic rights, which the Philippines argued are not applicable in deciding ownership of the South China Sea. The PCA agreed with the Philippine position. The tribunal concluded that there was no legal basis for China to claim historic rights to resources within the sea areas falling within the nine-dash line, said a PCA press release on the panel's judgment. Crucially, the Philippines lawyers urged the Hague court to define the precise nature of the bits of sand, rock, and reef in the South China Sea's Spratly Archipelago. Definition is key because only naturally formed islands that can support economic or human life give governments economic rights to a maximum 200 nautical miles of surrounding waters, including all oil, seafood, and other underwater resources. Bits of reef that poke out during high tide are eligible for 12 nautical miles of exclusive economic zones. Atolls that remain submerged during high tide qualify for no economic rights at all. Even if China has dredged sand and coral to turn reefs into islands bristling with military hardware, the Philippines maintained in their PCA case that the Spratly features under Chinese control were, at most, high tide elevations, not naturally formed islands. In its July 12th judgment, the tribunal concluded that none of the Spratly Islands is capable of generating extended maritime zones, according to the PCA press statement. The arbitration panel also ruled that having found that none of the features claimed by China was capable of generating an exclusive economic zone, the tribunal found that it could, without delimiting a boundary, declare that certain sea areas are within the exclusive economic zone of the Philippines because those areas are not overlapped by any possible entitlement of China. In other words, Chinese-controlled bits of rock and reef in the South China Sea are within waters that the Philippines can claim as its own. It's hard to imagine an international court judgment more damning to Beijing's maritime ambitions. Lawyers for Manila had suggested in their submissions that Chinese activity in waters claimed by the Philippines harmed the environment and that Chinese maritime authorities prevented Philippine fishermen from pursuing their livelihoods. The tribunal again agreed, deciding that China had violated the Philippines' sovereign rights in its exclusive economic zone by A. interfering with Philippine fishing and petroleum exploration, B. constructing artificial islands, and C. failing to prevent Chinese fishermen from fishing in the zone. The tribunal further found that China had caused severe harm to the coral reef environment and violated its obligation to preserve and protect fragile ecosystems and the habitat of depleted, threatened, or endangered species. For more than 3 years, China boycotted the entire proceedings, arguing that the PCA had no jurisdiction over the case and that the Philippines had promised to negotiate directly with China rather than resort to an international tribunal. But major powers urged China to hew to the panel's judgment, which is binding and cannot be appealed. Still, the court's decision is not enforceable. Nor will China dismantle its newly constructed islands in the South China Sea. In addition to Chinese state media's battle of words against the PCA, the Chinese People's Liberation Army engaged in live-fire drills in the northern part of the South China Sea last week. Just as the PCA ready to deliver its judgment, Vietnamese state media reported that Chinese ships had sunk Vietnamese fishing boats in disputed waters around the Paracels archipelago, a common complaint in recent years. What happens next? Earlier this year, Chinese military blogs published plans for Beijing to build up Scarborough Shoal in the same way that Spratly features have been transformed into artificial islands. The U.S., among others, urged China to resist building on Scarborough, and no Chinese dredgers were sighted off the coast of the Philippines this spring. But now that the PCA judgment has been awarded so decisively against China, Beijing could well initiate a new South China Sea construction site. At the same time, the Chinese government could declare an air defense identification zone over the South China Sea that would, in theory, compel foreign aircraft to identify themselves while traveling through that airspace. In 2013, Beijing declared a similar ADIZ over waters contested between Japan and China. In recent months, the U.S. has ramped up the presence of aircraft carrier strike groups in the South China Sea, carrying out so-called freedom of navigation exercises that have riled Beijing. Regional groupings, even the consensus-driven Association of Southeast Asian Nations, have been divided by debate over how to react to China's actions in the waterway. Now, with such a strong judgment against China, the PCA tribunal may have clarified where international law stands on Beijing's maritime claims, but it will do nothing to calm the already troubled waters of the South China Sea. This article posted by Hannah Beach in Shanghai. Meet 10 Bizarre and Beautiful Creatures from the Deep by Marissa Gertz. On July 10th, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Okeanos Explorer completed a 69-day, three-stage expedition of previously unknown and poorly understood deepwater habitats. The first leg, exploring the southern half of the Marianas Trench Marine National Monument and the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands, wrapped up on May 11th. This last leg explores the northern half of these protected marine areas. Scientists captured images and video of many of the incredible creatures that live at these extreme depths, some of them never seen before or found thriving in unexpected places. Due to its remote location, this area remains one of the last relatively pristine marine ecosystems on the planet, reports NOAA. Here are 10 of the bizarre and beautiful creatures that were discovered. Aphionid. This tiny ghost fish is the first of its family to be observed alive. It has transparent gelatinous skin, no scales, and pigmentless eyes. This fish was on the bucket list of many scientists watching the expedition, says fishery biologist Bruce Mundy. Spider crab. Two crabs fighting, including a white spider crab from the genus Rocinia, on the first ever exploration of the outer edge of the volcanic Maug cone. Bubblegum coral. It's easy to see how this brightly colored coral got its name. The green strands look like a plant, but they can't be. Due to lack of light, plants are not found at these depths. Scientists hypothesize that they could be a species of sponge or possibly drifting algae. A brittle star can be seen tightly wrapped around the center. Frogfish. The frogfish is a type of anglerfish. Squatting on the sea floor, it draws its prey close to its enormous mouth by wiggling a lure that extends out from between its eyes. It has modified fins that act like feet, allowing it to walk along the sea floor. Alicia anemone. This rare anemone, possibly in the genus Alicia, was found along the Ayi Seamount, a string of active submarine volcanoes. The anemone extends its tentacles at night to hunt. Chamorro vent. An unexpected discovery came in the form of a hydrothermal vent community in an area that had no known historic eruptions. The superheated water streaming from this vent contains minerals that sustain chemosynthetic bacteria, which in turn support communities of corals, snails, and shrimp. Long-spined sea urchin. This well-protected urchin with incredibly long, flexible spines was found on a crater along the side of the Ifuku Seamount at a depth of about 500 meters. Cusk eel. This bizarre-looking eel has a bulbous head with tiny eyes and a mouth placed so low it is almost underneath its body. These characteristics could mark it as a new species. Acorn worm. Found in a muddy area dubbed Twin Peaks, this vibrant worm uses its acorn-shaped head to burrow into the seafloor. Lizard fish. Lizard fish typically dwell on the seafloor where they lie in wait for their prey. Its long, flattened head filled with teeth give it its name. An author named Barack Obama, J.D., published an article on Monday in a scholarly journal. No prizes for guessing the topic. It's an assessment of the Affordable Care Act, as well as policy recommendations for the next president to improve the U.S. healthcare system. The article, titled United States Healthcare Reform, Progress to Date and Next Steps, was published by the Journal of the American Medical Association. The piece, which contains 68 footnotes to academic journals and government publications, claims to present evidence showing that the number of Americans without health insurance has dropped dramatically and resulted in lower hospital readmission rates. Obama also used the article to recommend the introduction of a public option plan in parts of the U.S. and for the federal government to push down drug prices. Reporters and scholars took to Twitter to note the president's initiative. One law professor, meanwhile, used the occasion to tease Obama that he was still beholden to his former life as an academic. Obama just published an article in JAMA, probably still feels pressure to crank out papers from 12 years at UChicago Law, Adam Chilton tweeted. While publication in JAMA is widely regarded as an impressive accomplishment, some may wish to take Obama's contribution with a grain of salt since it was not peer-reviewed and appears with a title of Special Contribution. Nonetheless, according to JAMA Editor-in-Chief Howard Bauchner, the article went through 2 months of fact-checking and multiple edits and revisions. While we, of course, recognize the author is the President of the United States, JAMA has enormously high standards, and we certainly expected the President to meet those standards, Bauchner told Bloomberg. Obama is the only author named on the article, though the President does credit 7 staff members for assistance with writing, research, and editing. The article comes as the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare, appears to be a central point of debate in the upcoming presidential election. Republican candidate Donald Trump has vowed to repeal the act, which is one of President Obama's signature legislative accomplishments. Hillary Clinton, meanwhile, has taken positions that mirror Obama's latest position on drug prices and on creating a public option for insurance. This article, posted by Jeff John Roberts, and originally appeared on Fortune.com. When Bernie Sanders arrives in Portsmouth, New Hampshire on Tuesday to endorse his bitter rival Hillary Clinton after overwhelmingly losing the Democratic primary, he will be holding a handful of policy victories. From free college to a tax on carbon emissions, Sanders has managed to finesse some of his liberal policies into the Democratic Party's platform and cajole Clinton's campaign into accepting some of his most liberal proposals. Weeks of backroom and telephone negotiations resulted in Sanders-backed policy ideas landing on Clinton's platform and in the Democratic Party's blueprint, outlined in a hefty platform draft that was finished last weekend in Orlando. Sanders' moderate successes brings him to Portsmouth on Tuesday with something of the swagger of a victor, despite failing by a long shot at his biggest goal of winning the nomination. "We have made enormous strides," Sanders boasted in a statement to reporters 2 days before his expected endorsement for Clinton. "Thanks to the millions of people across the country who got involved in the political process, many for the first time, we now have the most progressive platform in the history of the Democratic Party." Sanders' endorsement will be billed as a unity moment in the Democratic Party when its two wings, the Vermont senators and Clinton's, come together in an effort to defeat Donald Trump. Sanders, famously stubborn, would likely not give Clinton a full-throated backing without major concessions. In the short term, it could be a Pyrrhic victory. The policies laid out are not binding, and most of them would likely be rejected in a Republican-controlled Congress. Sanders lost on some major ideas, including Medicare for all and a fracking ban. And Sanders' victories may have come at a political price. For weeks after losing the primary, he refused to endorse Clinton, bucking tradition in both parties. He exasperated Democrats and worried even some of his own supporters. He was playing games with the Democratic platform, some detractors charged, and he was losing leverage the longer he refused to get on board. Would he risk installing Trump in the White House? It was a gamble that depended on Clinton and her allies to cooperate. In fact, Clinton's camp did play along in public negotiations in hotel lobbies and private back rooms between Sanders' campaign manager Jeff Weaver and his Clinton counterpart Robbie Mook, as well as their policy teams and political aides. Much of the platform was officially decided in meetings in St. Louis and Orlando, where Democratic delegates and party officials met to vote on various amendments and proposals. But Sanders' coyness in endorsing Clinton may have paid off. By withholding his endorsement, he pulled Clinton to the table. After all, Sanders could only ever endorse Clinton and help her win the White House if he really agreed with her platform. "We believe we got at least 80% of what we've been fighting for," said Warren Gunnels, Sanders' top policy advisor. And by pushing the ideas into the Democratic bloodstream, Sanders may yet see some of them enacted, although it could be years from now. Here's a look at some of the issues decided since the final primary in Washington, D.C. on June 14th. Making public college free. The Clinton and Sanders campaigns agreed last week on a policy that would make college free for all families making less than $125,000 per year, or 80% of American families. The proposal will revolutionize the funding of higher education in America, Sanders said. Sanders has pushed for universal free public college during the primary. The new plan is as close to Sanders' goal as he could have hoped. However, even if this plan passes Congress, the plan will be expensive and difficult to implement, and it would rely on skeptical states to take federal grants to pay for many thousands of students' tuition, a situation that tripped up the Affordable Care Act's implementation as well. Expanding health care coverage. Sanders did not achieve his favored proposal, which would give Americans government-paid-for health insurance paid for by a middle-class tax increase. Instead, he won a semblance of a compromise, which Clinton announced over the weekend, an expansion of community-based primary care services and establishing a public option insurance plan. "It is a significant step forward as we advance toward the goal of health care for all Americans," Sanders said in a call with reporters on Tuesday. The plan is nowhere close, however, to Sanders' Medicare for All plan, a large government program that was voted down by the Democratic Platform Committee. Instituting a $15 minimum wage. Over the weekend, Sanders supporters won firm language in the party platform in support of raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour. Clinton supported a $12 minimum wage during the Democratic primary, and her delegates initially opposed including firm language in the party platform. This was a centerpiece of Sanders' campaign speech. No firm language on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Both Sanders and Clinton opposed the massive new free trade deal in its current form, but Sanders went a step further. He wanted it to never even appear for a vote. He pushed for that specific language in the Democratic Party's platform, a move that would contravene the sitting president who supports the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The party refused, and Sanders lost. "The loss on TPP was a very significant defeat," said Gunnels, the policy advisor, who wanted to ensure it is not voted on in the lame duck session between the November election and the start of the next president's first term in January. More banking regulation. Sanders won a tenet in the party platform that recommends calls for breaking up large Wall Street institutions that are too big to fail and creating a wall between commercial and investment banking, or a modern-day Glass-Steagall Act. That was a position that Clinton did not support during the primary. She has her own Wall Street regulation plan that focuses on hedge funds and what the campaign has called shadow banking. Sanders' allies and progressives see this as a major victory. Abolishing the death penalty. The party's draft platform calls for abolishing the death penalty, a view that Sanders maintained during the primary. Clinton has supported the death penalty in rare cases. Taxing carbon emissions. A contentious platform issue that Clinton did not take a position on during the primary, Sanders pushed hard for a carbon tax, which conservatives see as a major burden on businesses. Sanders' delegates on the platform committee were able to push for an aggressive price on carbon and methane emissions. No ban on fracking. Sanders had made a ban on fracking a centerpiece of his campaign, culminating in a testy exchange during a Democratic debate. Clinton has said that she will regulate fracking. The Vermont senator campaigned on it heavily in New York State and employed surrogates to make his case, but the party platform ultimately voted against a fracking ban. Marijuana. The party platform calls for removing marijuana as a Schedule I drug, a category that includes drugs with no currently accepted medical use, like heroin. This was a position Sanders supported throughout the primary. This article posted by Sam Frizzell.
Once the optic nerve that's responsible for sight is damaged, it's impossible to see again. At least, that's been the dogma. But a group of U.S. scientists has upended that thinking and helped mice with destroyed optic nerves to see again. It does not have immediate implications for humans yet, but it points researchers in promising new directions. Andrew Huberman, an associate professor of neurobiology at Stanford University, and his team described their advance in a study published in Nature Neuroscience. To learn about the way vision nerves grow, they crushed the optic nerve in one eye of mice. Once destroyed, the long finger-like extensions sent out by nerve cells from the eye to the brain start to shrivel, eventually severing any connection to the brain and resulting in blindness. Huberman and his colleagues, however, found that a combination of visual stimulation of the nerve, along with nerve-growing chemicals, can rescue these extensions, called axons, and coax them to stretch out again. Not only that, but the axons are able to find their appropriate connections to the correct sight-dedicated parts of the brain to restore vision. Mice with similar damage to the nerve that didn't receive the treatment did not show much regrowth of the axons. About 3 weeks after the optic nerves in the mice were damaged, the researchers saw evidence of axons extending back into the brain from the eye, something that previous efforts to regenerate eye nerves haven't done with much reliability. The combination of keeping the damaged but remaining axons stimulated by exposing the mice to bars on a screen that are moving in different directions and the nerve growth factors lead to a 500-fold increase in axon regrowth. Granted, not all of the axons managed to sprout again, but those that did were able to do so with impressive speed and distance to reach the brain. When the researchers conducted 4 different tests to verify how much of the regrowth contributed to actual restoration of vision in the animals passed 2 of the tests that detected large objects and movement. For the longest time, people in the field wondered if neurons could regenerate and form the correct patterns to connect to the brain, and we found that they did, says Huberman. The most compelling finding is that the study suggests that once nerves are coaxed to grow again, they retain the instructions to find their proper connections in the brain's visual center. If nerves growing toward the brain are like visitors to New York's Grand Central Station, these nerves are like well-equipped travelers with maps and specific instructions for finding their destination. It means that neurons remember the way home. They never forget, says Huberman. That's encouraging him and his team to start considering how to translate the results to treat blindness in people. Keeping the axons stimulated by exposing them to stimuli is an easy first step. If these axons are kept alive, then they have a chance of regrowing again, as the mouse study showed. And now that it's possible to push those axons to grow long enough to reach the brain, there is hope that some people with diseases, like glaucoma, for example, might be able to retain their vision if they keep their compromised axons stimulated enough and then eventually treat them with nerve growth factors. That may be a few years away yet for people, but Huberman is hopeful. "I want to see something positive in humans within 5 years," he says. This article posted by Alice Park. Amazon is hosting its second annual Prime Day sales event on Tuesday, July 12th, and like last year, Amazon's competitors don't want the world's largest e-retailer to get away with attracting all of the attention and sales. In the same way that Walmart, Target, and Best Buy hosted big sales timed to coincide with Prime Day 2015, many retailers have launched special promotions to try to steal some thunder away from Amazon's much-hyped Black Friday in summer. They aren't waiting for Prime Day itself, either, as most sales from Amazon competitors are underway right now. Bear in mind that the deals from Amazon's competitors avoid mention of the phrase Prime Day because they don't want to give Amazon a free plug. The day is named for Amazon's Prime service, and Amazon's deals are only available to Prime members. Amazon uses this exclusivity as a way to increase Prime subscribers, who must pay $99 per year, or $10.99 monthly, after a free 30-day trial, and who tend to spend big bucks on Amazon.com once they're members. The most important part of what makes deals from other retailers different from those offered by Amazon on Prime Day is that the former require no membership or annual fee whatsoever. Walmart, in particular, has highlighted the fact that its sales are available for anybody, unlike Amazon's deals, which can only be purchased by members of a store's special club. Walmart is also ratcheting up the competition this summer by offering free, no-minimum-purchase shipping this week, as well as a free 30-day trial of Shipping Pass, its two-day shipping service that costs $49 annually. If you're really trying to save money, the smartest approach is probably to simply ignore the whole thing and pretend that Amazon Prime Day and all of its manufactured sales events aren't happening. After all, these sales are concocted with the idea of getting you to spend at a time you wouldn't otherwise, and there will surely be an endless stream of amazing discounts during heavily promoted sales events down the line. But if you're going to shop, and who are we kidding? We know everybody's going to do at least some browsing. It's wise to scout out the best deals from multiple stores rather than just focusing solely on Amazon. And remember, if you make a purchase from any retailer other than Amazon, you won't have to sign up for Prime, and you won't wind up hooked into paying for any kind of subscription service. Here are the big sales we know about so far. We'll add to the list as more worthy Prime Day alternatives arise. Walmart. To steal sales away from Amazon, Walmart is offering free shipping on all orders, no minimum purchase required, no membership required, from Monday, July 11th to Friday, July 15th. What's more, the retailer has announced thousands of rollback deals valid for this week, and sometimes longer, such as an Xbox One console bundle with Gears of War and Minecraft for $280, normally priced $355. A 55-inch Samsung HD TV for $598, normally $1,199, and an Apple iPhone 5S 16GB with prepaid Straight Talk service for $149, previously $450. Newegg. Last week, the electronics e-retailer Newegg announced it would be unleashing a huge Fantas Tech sale that starts with a few teaser deals at 10 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time, on Monday, July 11th. The bulk of the sale will kick in on midnight tonight, 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, just like with Amazon Prime Day. Newegg hosted a Fantas Tech sale last year, timed to coincide with Prime Day 2015. Gap. The apparel retailer is having a sale with up to 60% off select items, plus a flat 40% off your entire purchase on July 11th, with use of the coupon code SUN. JCPenney. A Pennypalooza sales event is in effect for Monday and Tuesday of this week, with an extra 25% off the lowest price listed. 30% off if you're using your JCP credit card for your entire purchase. In some cases, the end discount will be more than 75% off original prices, which, we must point out, are usually extremely inflated. Use the code NEWLOOK6 to get the extra discount at checkout. Toys R Us. A Super Brands sale is in effect from July 11th to the 14th, featuring discounts like 30% off Legos and 20% off Nerf. The toy retailer is also offering 15% off all regularly priced items on July 12th, in addition to more sales. Best Buy. The electronics retailer's new sales take is an obvious swipe at Prime Day by announcing it is offering deals for all, no membership needed. As for the deals themselves, well, they don't seem all that different from Best Buy's usual weekly promotions. For instance, there's a 50-inch Sharp Smart HD TV with a $430 list price that's now on sale for $350. Kohl's. The store is promising different Beat the Heat buys each day through July 14th. Look for 50% off, 60% off, and sometimes even bigger discounts on clothes, home furnishings, and more. Sears. Among the sales are 25% off all bikes and up to 60% off clothing and accessories. This article posted by Brad Tuttle. The Republican Party's platform may be making a turn for the right as GOP delegates gather in Cleveland to formulate the party's principles document. Social conservative priorities have dominated the discussion. Several provisions, opposition to same-sex marriage and endorsing controversial conversion therapy, passing preliminary votes Monday. The platform committee's subcommittee on health care, education, and crime approved several of the measures in a sometimes heated discussion between social conservatives and more moderate Republicans that represent a more conservative shift from the draft platform authored by Republican National Committee staff and outside advisors. Among the provisions is an assessment that internet pornography is a public health crisis. Pornography, with its harmful effects, especially on children, has become a public health crisis that is destroying the life of millions. We encourage states to continue to fight this public menace and pledge our commitment to children's safety and well-being, the amendment states. An amendment offered by the Family Research Council's Tony Perkins offered support for the controversial practice of conversion therapy for children who identify as LGBT. "We support the right of parents to determine the proper treatment or therapy for their minor children," the amendment said. Perkins originally drafted a more explicit embrace of the practice, but amended the text after consultations with top RNC officials. Perkins' amendment, which passed the subcommittee, also calls for legislation to require parental consent for minor women to cross state lines for the purposes of obtaining an abortion. The subcommittee strengthened the platform's language in opposition to same-sex marriage. The initial draft, circulated late Sunday to committee members, stated, "Our laws and our government's regulations should recognize marriage as the union of one man and one woman and actively promote married family life as the basis of a stable and prosperous society. For that reason, as explained elsewhere in this platform, we do not accept the Supreme Court's redefinition of marriage and we urge its reversal, whether through judicial reconsideration or a constitutional amendment returning control over marriage to the states." Annie Dickerson, a New York delegate and longtime confidant to GOP billionaire Paul Singer, who has bankrolled an effort to push back against the social conservative planks, was the most ardent voice in opposition on the committee, repeatedly sparring with Perkins and other members. The subcommittee also considered several bathroom amendments following the ongoing controversy in North Carolina, which requires transgender individuals to use bathrooms as their birth gender rather than how they identify. "I think this takes us to a dark place," Dickerson said. "It shrinks our tent. We should be about addition, not subtraction," she added. West Virginia National Committeewoman Melody Potter disagreed, speaking in favor of amendments to echo the North Carolina law, which has sparked a backlash in the state. "Nobody wants to discriminate against anybody, but I think it's an issue of safety." The measure ultimately passed. an amendment that sought to argue that gay marriage subverts child's rights to biological parents, drew condemnation from the moderate members, including an audible gasp of, "Hello, what was that?" The committee also considered an amendment calling for allowing the teaching of the Bible as part of American history. The separate subcommittee on restoring constitutional government approved its own language opposing same-sex marriage, designed to dovetail with the language from the Health Committee, said author and GOP lawyer Jim Bopp. An aide to Donald Trump, Michael Biondo, was in the room as the subcommittee met, but didn't offer any guidance or input. Perkins told reporters that Trump's campaign was allowing the committee to work autonomously, calling it a break from the practice of previous presumptive nominees who have been more invested in the platform discussions. The full platform committee is set to take up the reports from the subcommittees later Monday and Tuesday, with the final platform expected to be set Tuesday afternoon. The full committee is made up of two delegates from each of the 56 delegations, all 50 states, the District of Columbia, and U.S. territories. This article posted by Zeke J. Miller in Cleveland.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.